Ethan's accident, Tim said. In spite of his anxiety, he was curious about this turn of the conversation. My mama sent them a soup, even though she was in mourning for my dad at the time. The tree fell across his back, but not square across. That would have killed him. What of it? He's better these days. They were near the water now, but the smell here was less strong, and Tim heard none of those smacking bugs. That was good, but the Pookie was still watching them with hungry interest. Bad.
Yar. Square fella Cosy's back to work, and we all say, thank ya. But while he was laid up, for 2 weeks before your da met his dragon, and for 6 weeks after, this stub and all the others in the Cosington Marchley stake were empty, because Ernie Marchley's not like your steppa, which is to say, he won't come cutting in the endless forest without a pard. But of course, also not like your steppa, slow Ernie actually has a pard.
Tim remembered the coin lying against his skin and why he'd come on this mad errand in the first place. There was no dragon. If there'd been a dragon, it would have burned up my da's lucky coin with the rest of him. And why was it in Kells's trunk?
Dump out my basin, young Tim. I think you'll find there are no bugs in the water to trouble thee. No, not here.
But I want to know...
Close thy clam and dump my basin, for you'll not leave this clearing while it's full.
Tim knelt to do as he was told, wanting only to complete the chore and be gone. He cared nothing about Peter Squarefella Cosington, and didn't believe the man in the black cloak did either. He's teasing me, or torturing me, maybe he doesn't even know the difference, but as soon as this damn basin is empty, I'll mount Bitsy and ride back as fast as I can. Let him try and stop me, just let him try. Tim's thoughts broke his cleanly as a dry stick under a boot heel. He lost his hold on the basin, and it fell upsy-turvy in the matted underbrush. There were no bugs in the water here. The Covenant Man was right about that. The stream was as clear as the water that flowed from the spring near their cottage. Lying 6 or 8 inches below the surface was a human body. The clothes were only rags that floated in the current. The eyelids were gone, and so was most of the hair. The face and arms, once deeply tanned, were now as pale as alabaster. But otherwise, the body of Big Jack Ross was perfectly preserved. If not for the emptiness in those lidless, lashless eyes, Tim could have believed his father might rise, dripping, and fold him into an embrace. The Pookie made its hungry sloop. Something broke inside of Tim at the sound, and he began to scream. The Covenant Man was forcing something into Tim's mouth. Tim tried to fend him off, but it did no good. The Covenant Man simply seized Tim's hair at the back of his head, and when Tim yelled, the mouth of a flask was shoved between his teeth. Some fiery liquid gushed down his throat. Not red eye, for instead of making him drunk, it calmed him. More, it made him feel like an icy visitor in his own head.
"That will wear off in 10 minutes, and then I'll let you go your course," the Covenant Man said.
His jocularity was gone. He no longer called the boy Young Tim. He no longer called him anything.
"Now, dig out thy ears and listen. I began to hear stories in Tavares, 40 wheels east of here, of a woodsman who had been cooked by a dragon. It was on everyone's lips. A bitch dragon as big as a house, they said. I knew it was bullshit. I believe there might still be a tiger somewhere in the forest."
At that, the Covenant Man's lips twitched in a rictus of a grin, there and gone almost too quickly to see.
"But a dragon? Never. There hasn't been one this close to civilization for years 10 times 10, and never one as big as a house." My curiosity was aroused. Not because Big Ross is a taxpayer, or was, although that's what I'd have told the toothless multitude, were any member of it trig enough and brave enough to ask. No, it was curiosity for its own sake, because wanting to know secrets has always been my besetting vice. Someday 'twill be the death of me, I have no doubt. I was camped on the Ironwood Trail last night, too, before I started my rounds. Only last night I went all the way to the trail's end. The signs on the last few stubs before the Fagonard Swamp say Ross and Kells. There I filled my basin at the last clear stream before the swamp begins. And what did I see in the water? Why, a sign reading Cosington Marchley. I packed up my gunner, mounted Blackie, and rode him back here just to see what I might see. There was no need to consult the basin again. I saw where yon Pookie would not venture, and where the bugs hadn't polluted the stream. The bugs are voracious flesh-eaters, but according to the old wives, they'll not eat the flesh of a virtuous man. The old wives are often wrong, but not about that, it seems. The chill of the water has preserved him, and he appears to be unmarked, because the man who murdered him struck from behind. I saw the riven skull when I turned him over, and have put him back as you see him now, to spare you that sight. The Covenant man paused, then added, "And so he'd see you, I suppose, if his essence lingers near his course." On that the old wives reached no consensus. "Still all right, or would you like another small dose of Nin?"
I'm all right." Never had he told such a lie.
I felt quite sure of who the culprit was, as you do, I reckon. But any remaining doubts were put to rest at Giddy's Saloon, my first stop in Tree. The local boozer's always good for a dozen knocks come tax time, if not more. There I found out that Byrne Kells had slipped the rope with his dead partner's widow.
"Because of you," Tim said in a monotone that didn't sound like his own voice at all. "Because of your God's damned taxes." The Covenant man laid a hand on his breast and spoke in wounded tones.
"You wrong me. 'Twasn't taxes that kept Big Kells burning in his bed all these years. Aye, even when he still had a woman next to him to quench his torch."
He went on, but the stuff he called Nin was wearing off, and Tim lost the sense of the words. Suddenly he was no longer cold but hot, burning up, and his stomach was a churning bag. He staggered toward the remains of the campfire, fell on his knees, and vomited his supper into the hole the Covenant man had been digging with his boot heel.
"There," the man in the black cloak said in a tone of hearty self-congratulation. "I thought that might come in handy." "You'll want to go see your mother now," said the Covenant man, when Tim had finished puking and was sitting beside the dying campfire with his head down and his hair hanging in his eyes. "Good son that you are. But I have something you may want. One more minute. It'll make no difference to Nell Kells. She is as she is."
"Don't call her so," Tim spat.
"How can I not? Is she not wed? Marry in haste, repent at leisure, the old folken say."
The Covenant man squatted once more in front of his heaped gunna, his cloak billowing around him like the wings of an awful bird.
"They also say, what slipped cannot be unslipped, and they say true. An amusing concept called divorce exists on some levels of the tower, but not in our charming little corner of Midworld. Now, let me see. It's here somewhere."
"I don't understand why Square Peter and Slow Ernie didn't find him," Tim said dully. He felt deflated, empty. Some emotion still pulsed deep in his heart, but he didn't know what it was. "This is their plot, their stake. They've been cutting ever since Cosington was well enough to work again."
"Aye, they cut the iron, but not here. They've plenty of other stubs. They've left this one fallow for a bit. Does thee not know why?"
Tim supposed he did. Square Peter and Slow Ernie were good and kindly, but not the bravest men ever to log the iron, which was why they didn't go much deeper into the forest than this. "They've been waiting for the Pookie to move on, I wot."
"It's a wise child," the Covenant man said approvingly. "He wots well. And how does thee think thy step of felt, knowing yon tree worm might move on at any time and those two come back? Come back and find his crime, unless he screws up enough gut to come himself and move the body deeper into the woods."
The new emotion in Tim's heart was pulsing more strongly now. He was glad. Anything was better than the helpless terror he felt for his mother. "I hope he feels bad. I hope he can't sleep." And then, with dawning understanding, "It's why he went back to the drink."
"A wise child indeed, wise beyond his—ah, here it is."
The Covenant man turned toward Tim, who was now untying Bitsy and preparing to mount up. He approached the boy, holding something beneath his cloak.
He did it on impulse, sure. And afterwards he must have been in a panic. Why else would he concoct such a ridiculous story? The other woodsmen doubted, of that you may be sure. He built a fire, and leaned into it as far as he dared, and for as long as he could take it, scorching his clothes and blistering his skin. I know, because I built my fire on the bones of his. But first, he threw his dead pard's gunna across yon stream, as far into the woods as his strength would allow. Did it with your da's blood not yet dry on his hands, I warrant. I waded across and found it. Most of it's useless, Mickle, but I saved thee one thing. It was rusty, but my pumice stone and honing bar have cleaned it up very well.
From beneath his cloak, he produced Big Ross's hand axe. Its freshly sharpened edge glittered. Tim, now astride Bitsy, took it, brought it to his lips, and kissed the cold steel. Then he shoved the handle into his belt, blade turned out from his body, just as Big Ross had taught him once upon a by.
I see you wear a rhodite double around your neck. Was it your da's?
Mounted, Tim was almost eye to eye with the Covenant man. It was in that murdering bastard's trunk.
You have his coin. Now you have his axe as well. Where will you put it, I wonder, if Ka offers you the chance?
In his head. The emotion, pure rage, had broken free of his heart like a bird with its wings on fire. Back or front, either will do me fine.
Admirable. I like a boy with a plan. Go with all the gods you know, and the man Jesus for good measure.
Then, having wound the boy to his fullest stop, he turned to build up his fire.
I may bide along the iron for another night or two. I find trees strangely interesting this wide earth. Watch for the green sig, my boy. She glows, so she does.
Tim made no reply, but the Covenant man felt sure he had heard. Once they were wound to the fullest stop, they always did. The Widow Smack must have been watching from the window, for Tim had just led a footsore Bitsy up to the porch. In spite of his growing anxiety, he had walked the last half mile to spare her, when she came rushing out.
Thank gods! Thank gods! Your mother was three-quarters to believing you were dead. Come in. Hurry. Let her hear and touch you.
The import of these words didn't strike Tim fully until later. He tied Bitsy beside Sunshine and hurried up the steps.
How did you know to come to her, Si?
The widow turned her face to him, which, given her veil, was hardly a face at all.
Has thee gone soft in the head, Timothy? You rode past my house, pushing that mule for all she was worth. I couldn't think why you'd be out so late, and headed in the direction of the forest, so I came here to ask your mother. But come, come, and keep a cheery voice if you love her.
The widow led him across the living room, where two seniors burned low. In his mother's room, another senior burned on the bed table, and by its light, he saw Nell lying in bed with much of her face wrapped in bandages, and another, this one badly bloodstained, around her neck like a collar. At the sound of their footsteps, she sat up with a wild look on her face.
If it's Kells, stay away. You've done enough.
It's Tim, Mama. She turned toward him and held out her arms.
Tim, to me, to me.
He knelt beside the bed, and the part of her face not covered by bandages, he covered with kisses, crying as he did so. She was still wearing her nightgown, but now the neck and bosom were stiff with rusty blood. Tim had seen his stepper fetch her a terrible lick with the ceramic jug, and then commence with his fists. How many blows had he seen? He didn't know. And how many had fallen on his hapless mother after the vision in the silver basin had disappeared? Enough so he knew she was very fortunate to be alive, but one of those blows, likely the one dealt with the ceramic jug, had struck his mother blind.
"'Twas a concussive blow," the Widow Smack said.
She sat in Nell's bedroom rocker. Tim sat on the bed, holding his mother's left hand.
two fingers of the right were broken. The widow, who must have been very busy since her fortuitous arrival, had splinted them with pieces of kindling and flannel strips torn from another of Nell's nightgowns. "I've seen it before. They're swelling to the brain. When it goes down, her sight may return." "May," Tim said bleakly. "There will be water if God wills it, Timothy."
Our water is poison now, Tim thought, and it was none of any God's doing.
He opened his mouth to say just that, but the widow shook her head. "She's asleep. I gave her an herb drink. Not strong. I didn't dare give her strong after he cuffed her so around the head, but it's taken hold. I wasn't sure 'twould."
Tim looked down at his mother's face, terribly pale, with freckles of blood still drying on the little exposed skin the widow's bandagements had left, and then back up at his teacher. "She'll wake again, won't she?"
The widow repeated, "There will be water if God wills it."
Then the ghost mouth beneath the veil lifted in what might have been a smile.
"In this case, I think there will be. She's strong, your ma."
"Can I talk to you, Si? For if I don't talk to someone, I'll explode."
"Of course. Come out on the porch. I'll stay here tonight, by your leave. Will you have me? And will you stable Sunshine, if so?"
"Aye," Tim said. In his relief, he actually managed to smile. "And say thank you." The air was even warmer. Sitting in the rocker that had been Big Ross's favorite roost on summer nights, the widow said,
"It feels like stark blast weather. Call me crazy, you wouldn't be the first, but so it does."
"What's that, Si?"
"Never mind, it's probably nothing, unless you see Sir Throckin dancing in the starlight or looking north with his muzzle upraised, that is. There hasn't been a stark blast in these parts since I was a wee bee, and that's many and many a year agone. We've other things to talk about. Is it only what that beast did to your mother that troubles you so, or is there more?"
Tim sighed, not sure how to start.
"I see a coin around your neck that I believe I've seen around your father's. Perhaps that's where you'll begin. But there's one thing we'd have to speak of first, and that's protecting your ma. I'd send you to Constable Howard's, no matter it's late, but his house is dark and shuttered. I saw that for myself on my way here. No surprise, either. Everyone knows that when the Covenant Man comes to Tree, Howard Tasley finds some reason to make himself scarce. I'm an old woman, and you're but a child. What will we do if Byrne Kells comes back to finish what he started?"
Tim, who no longer felt like a child, reached down to his belt. "My father's coin isn't all I found tonight." He pulled Big Ross's hand axe and showed it to her. "This was also my da's, and if he dares come back, I'll put it in his head, where it belongs." The widow Smack began to remonstrate, but saw a look in his eyes that made her change direction.
"Tell me your tale," said she. "Leave out not a word."
When Tim had finished, minding the widow's command to leave nothing out, he made sure to tell what his mother had said about the peculiar changelessness of the man with the silver basin. His old teacher sat quietly for a moment, although the night breeze caused her veil to flutter eerily and made her look as though she were nodding.
"She's right, you know," she said at last. "Yon cherry man hasn't aged a day, and tax collecting's not his job. I think it's his hobby. He's a man with hobbies. Aye, he has his little pastimes."
She raised her fingers in front of her veil, appeared to study them, then returned them to her lap.
"You're not shaking," Tim ventured. "No, not tonight, and that's a good thing if I'm to sit vigil at your mother's bedside, which I mean to do. You, Tim, will make yourself a pallet behind the door. 'Twill be uncomfortable, but if your steppa comes back, and if you're to have a chance against him, you'll have to come at him from behind. Not much like Brave Bill in the stories, is it?"
Tim's hands rolled shut, the fingernails digging into his palms. "It's how the bastard did for my da, and all he deserves." She took one of his hands in her own and soothed it open.
"He'll probably not come back, anyway. Certainly not if he thinks he's done for her, and he may.
There was so much blood.
Bastard, Tim said in a low and choking voice.
He's probably lying up drunk somewhere. Tomorrow you must go to Square Peter Cosington and Slow Ernie Marchley, for it's their patch where your Darnell lies. Show them the coin you wear, and tell them how you found it in Kells's trunk. They can round up a posse and search until Kells is found and locked up tight in the jailhouse. It won't take them long to run him down, I warrant, and when he comes back sober, he'll claim he has no idea of what he's done. He may even be telling the truth, for when it gets in some men, strong drink draws down a curtain. I'll go with them.
Nay, it's no work for a boy. Bad enough you have to watch for him tonight with your da's hand axe. Tonight you need to be a man. Tomorrow you can be a boy again, and a boy's place, when his mother has been badly hurt, is by her side.
The Covenant man said he might bide along the Ironwood Trail for another night or two. Maybe I should... The hand that had soothed moments before now grasped Tim's wrist where the flesh was thin and hard enough to hurt.
Never think it. Hasn't he done damage enough?
What are you saying? That he made all this happen? It was Kells who killed my da, and it was Kells who beat my mama.
But 'twas Covenant Man who gave you the key, and there's no telling what else he may have done, or will do if he gets the chance, for he leaves ruin and weeping in his wake, and has for time out of mind. Do you think people only fear him because he has the power to turn them out on the land if they can't pay the barony taxes?
No, Tim, no.
Do you know his name?
Nay, nor need to, for I know what he is. Pestilence with a heartbeat. Once upon a by, after he'd done a foul business here I'd not talk about to a boy, I determined to find out what I could. I wrote a letter to a great lady I knew long ago in Gilead, a woman of discretion as well as beauty, a rare combination, and paid good silver for a messenger to take it and bring a reply, which my correspondent in the great city begged me to burn. She said that when Gilead's Covenant man is not at his hobby of collecting taxes, a job that comes down to licking the tears from the faces of poor working folk, he's an advisor to the palace lords who call themselves the Council of Eld, although it's only themselves who claim they have any blood connection to the Eld. 'Tis said he's a great mage, and there may be at least some truth in that, for you've seen his magic at work.
So I have, Tim said, thinking of the basin. And of the way Cy Covenant Man seemed to grow taller when he was wroth.
My correspondent said that there are even some who claim he is Merlin, he who was court mage to Arthur Eld himself, for Merlin was said to be eternal, a creature who lives backward in time.
From behind the veil came a snorting sound.
Just thinking of it makes my head hurt, for such an idea makes no earthly sense.
But Merlin was a white magician, or so the stories do say.
Those who claim the Covenant Man's Merlin in disguise say he was turned evil by the glam of the wizard's rainbow, for he was given the keeping of it in the days before the Elden Kingdom fell. Others say, during his wanderings after the fall, he discovered certain artifacts of the old people, became fascinated by them, and was blackened by them to the bottom of his soul. This happened in the Endless Forest, they say, where he still keeps a magic house, where time stands still.
Doesn't seem too likely, Tim said, although he was fascinated by the idea of a magic house where clock hands never moved and sand never fell in the glass.
Bullshit is what it is!
And noting his shocked look,
cry your pardon, but sometimes only vulgarity will serve. Even Merlin couldn't be two places at the same time, mooning around the Endless Forest at one end of the Northard Barony and serving the lords and gunslingers of Gilead at the other. Nay, the taxman's no Merlin, but he is a magician, a black one. So said the lady I once taught, and so I believe. That's why you must never go near him again. Any good he offers to do you will be a lie.
Tim considered this, then asked, "Do you know what a Sigg is, Cy?"
"Of course. The Sigg are fairy folk who supposedly live in the deep woods. Did the dark man speak of them?"
"No, 'twas just some story Straw Willem told me one day at the sawmill."
Now, Why did I lie? But deep in his heart, Tim knew. Burnkells didn't come back that night, which was for the best. Tim meant to stay on guard, but he was just a boy and exhausted. "I'll close my eyes for a few seconds to rest them," was what he told himself when he lay down on the straw pallet he made for himself behind the door, and it felt like no more than a few seconds, but when he opened them again, the cottage was filled with morning light. His father's axe lay on the floor beside him where his relaxing hand had dropped it. He picked it up, put it back in his belt, and hurried into the bedroom to see his mother. The widow Smack was fast asleep in the Tavares rocker, which she had drawn up close to Nell's bed, her veil fluttering with her snores. Nell's eyes were wide open, and they turned toward the sound of Tim's steps. "Who comes?" "Tim, Mama." He sat beside her on the bed. "Has your sight come back, even a little?" She tried to smile, but her swollen mouth could do little more than twitch. "Still dark, I'm afraid." "It's all right." He raised the hand that wasn't splinted and kissed the back of it. "Probably still too early." Their voices roused the widow. "He says true, Nell." "Blind or not, next year we'll be turned out for sure. And then what?" Nell turned her face to the wall and began to cry. Tim looked at the widow, not sure what to do. She motioned for him to leave. "I'll give her something to calm her. 'Tis in my bag. You have men to see, Tim. Go at once, or they'll be off to the woods." He might have missed Peter Cosington and Ernie Marchley anyway, if Baldy Anderson, one of Tree's big farmers, hadn't stopped by the pair's storing shed to chat as they hitched their mules and prepared for the day. The three men listened to his story in grim silence, and when Tim finally stumbled to a halt, telling them his mother was still blind this morning, Square Peter gripped Tim by the upper arms and said, "Count on us, boy. We'll rouse every axe man in town, those who work the Blossies as well as those who go up the Ironwood. There'll be no cutting in the forest today." Anderson said, "And I'll send my boys around to the farmers, to Destry and to the sawmill as well."
"What about the constable?" Slow Ernie asked, a trifle nervously.
Anderson dipped his head, spat between his boots, and wiped his chin with the heel of his hand. "Gone up Tavares way, I hear. Either looking for poachers or visiting the woman he keeps up there. Makes no difference. Howard Tasley ain't never been worth a fart in a high wind. We'll do the job ourselves and have Kells jugged by the time he comes back."
"With a pair of broken arms if he kicks up rough," Cosington added. "He's never been able to hold his drink or his temper. He was all right when he had Jack Ross to rein him in, but look what it's come to. Nell Ross beaten blind. Big Kells always kept a warm eye for her, and the only one who didn't know it was..."
Anderson hushed him with an elbow, then turned to Tim, bending forward with his hands on his knees, for he was tallish. "'Twas the Covenant man who found your Da's corpse?"
"Aye."
"And you saw the body yourself?" Tim's eyes filled, but his voice was steady enough. "Aye, so I did."
"On our stake," Slow Ernie said, "to back of one of our stubs, the one where the Pookies set up housekeeping."
"Aye."
"I could kill him just for that," Cosington said, "but we'll bring him in alive if we can. Ernie, you and me'd best ride up there and bring back the, you know, remains, before we get in on the search. Baldy, can you get the word around on your own?"
"Aye, we'll gather at the Mercantile. Keep a good eye out along the Ironwood Trail as you go, boys, but my best guess is we'll find the booger in town, laid up drunk."
And more to himself than the others.
"I never believed that dragon story."
"Start behind Giddy's," Slow Ernie said. "He's slept it off there more than once."
"So we will."
Baldy Anderson looked up at the sky.
"I don't care much for this weather. Tell you true, it's too warm for wide earth. I hope it don't bring a storm, and I hope to gods it don't bring a stark blast. That'd cap everything. Wouldn't be none of us able to pay the Covenant man when he comes next year. Although if it's true what the boy says, he's turned a bad apple out of the basket and done us a service."
"He didn't do my mama one," Tim thought.
If he hadn't given me that key, and if I hadn't used it, she'd still have her sight.
"Go on home now," Marchley said to Tim.
He spoke kindly, but in a tone that brooked no argument. "Stop by my house on the way, do you, and tell my wife this lady's wanted at yours. Widow Smack must need to go home and rest, for she's neither young nor well. Also," he sighed, "tell her they'll be wanted at Stokes' burying parlor later on." This time, Tim had taken Misty, and she was the one who had to stop and nibble at every bush. By the time he got home, two wagons and a pony trap had passed him, each carrying a pair of women, eager to help his mother in her time of hurt and trouble. He had no more than stabled Misty next to Bitsy before Ada Cosington was on the porch, telling him he was needed to drive the Widow Smack home. "You can use my pony trap. Go gentle where there's ruts, for the poor woman's fair done up."
"Has she got her shake, Si?"
"Nay, I think the poor thing's too tired to shake. She was here when she was most needed and may have saved your mama's life. Never forget that."
"Can my mother see again, even a little?"
Tim knew the answer from Si Cosington's face before she opened her mouth. "Not yet, son. You must pray." Tim thought of telling her what his father had sometimes said. "Pray for rain all you like, but dig a well as you do it." In the end, he kept silent. It was a slow trip to the widow's house with her little burro tied to the back of Ada Cosington's pony trap. The unseasonable heat continued, and the sweet-sour breezes that usually blew from the endless forest had fallen still. The widow tried to say cheerful things about Nell, but soon gave up. Tim supposed they sounded as false to her ears as they did to his own. Halfway up the high street, he heard a thick, gurgling sound from his right. He looked around, startled, then relaxed. The widow had fallen asleep, with her chin resting on her bird-like chest. The hem of her veil lay in her lap. When they reached her house on the outskirts of the village, he offered to see her inside.
"Nay, only help me up the steps, and after that I'll be fine-o. I want tea with honey and then my bed, for I'm that tired."
"You need to be with your mother now, Tim. I know half the ladies in town will be there by the time you get back, but it's you she needs." For the first time in the 5 years he'd had her as a schoolteacher, she gave Tim a hug. It was dry and fierce. He could feel her body thrumming beneath her dress. She wasn't too tired to shake after all, it seemed, nor too tired to give comfort to a boy, a tired, angry, deeply confused boy who badly needed it. "Go to her, and stay away from that dark man should he appear to thee. He's made of lies from boots to crown, and his gospels bring nothing but tears." On his way back down the high street, he encountered Straw Willem and his brother Hunter, known as Spot Hunter for his freckles, riding to meet the posse, which had gone out Tree Road.
"They mean to search every stake and stub on the Ironwood," Spot Hunter said excitedly. "We'll find him."
The posse hadn't found Kells in town after all, it seemed. Tim had a feeling they'd not find him along the iron, either. There was no basis for the feeling, but it was strong. So was his feeling that the Covenant man hadn't finished with him yet. The man in the black cloak had had some of his fun, but not all of it. His mother was sleeping, but woke when Ada Cosington ushered him in. The other ladies sat about the main room, but they had not been idle while Tim was away. The pantry had been mysteriously stocked. Every shelf groaned with bottles and sacks, and although Nell was a fine country housekeeper, Tim had never seen the place looking so snick. Even the overhead beams had been scrubbed clean of wood smoke. Every trace of burned Kells had been removed. The awful trunk had been banished to beneath the back porch stoop to keep company with the spiders, field mice, and more toads. "Tim?" And when he put his hands in Nell's, which were reaching out, she sighed with relief. "All right? Aye, Mama, passing fine." This was a lie, and they both knew it.
We knew he was dead, didn't we? But it's no comfort. It's as if he's been killed all over again.
Tears began to spill from her sightless eyes. Tim cried himself, but managed to do it silently. Hearing him sob would do her no good.
They'll bring him to the little burying parlor Stokes keeps out behind his smithy. Most of these kind ladies will go to him there to do the fitting things, but will you go to him first, Timmy? Will you take him your love and all of mine? For I can't. The man I was fool enough to marry has lamed me so badly I can hardly walk, and of course I can't see anything. What a Kamai I turned out to be, and what a price we've paid.
Hush. I love you, Mama. Of course I'll go.
But because there was time, he went first to the barn. There were far too many women in the cottage for his taste, and made a jack-leg bed with hay and an old mule blanket. He fell asleep almost at once. He was awakened around 3 o'clock by Square Peter, who held his hat clasped to his breast and wore an expression of sad solemnity. Tim sat up, rubbing his eyes. "Have you found Kells?"
"Nay, lad, but we found your father and brought him back to town. Your mother says you'll pay respects for the both of you. Does she say true?"
"Aye, yes."
Tim stood up, brushing hay from his pants and shirt. He felt ashamed to have been caught sleeping, but his rest the previous night had been thin and haunted by bad dreams. "Come, then. We'll take my wagon."
The burying parlor behind the smithy was the closest thing the town had to a mortuary in a time when most country folk preferred to see to their own dead, interring them on their own land with a wooden cross or a slab of roughly carved stone to mark the grave. Dustin Stokes, inevitably known as Hot Stokes, stood outside the door, wearing white cotton pants instead of his usual leathers. Over them billowed a vast white shirt, falling all the way to the knees so it looked almost like a dress. Looking at him, Tim remembered it was customary to wear white for the dead. He understood everything in that moment, realizing the truth in a way that not even looking at his father's open-eyed corpse in running water had been able to make him realize it, and his knees loosened. Square Peter bore him up with a strong hand.
"Can he do it, lad? For if he can't, there's no shame. He was your da, and I know you loved him well."
"We all did."
"I'll be all right," Tim said. He couldn't seem to get enough air into his lungs, and the words came out in a whisper. Hot Stokes put his fist to his forehead and bowed. It was the first time in his life that Tim had been saluted as a man.
"I'll Tim, son of Jack. His car's gone into the clearing, but what's left is here. Will he come and see?"
"Yes, please."
Square Peter stayed behind, and now it was Stokes who took Tim's arm. Stokes, not dressed in his leather breeches and cursing as he fanned an open furnace hole with his bellows, but clad in ceremonial white. Stokes, who led him into the little room with forest scenes painted on the walls all around. Stokes, who took him to the ironwood bier in the center, that open space that had ever represented the clearing at the end of the path. Big Jack Ross also wore white, although his was a fine linen shroud. His lidless eyes stared raptly at the ceiling. Against one painted wall leaned his coffin, and the room was filled with the sour yet somehow pleasant smell of it, for the coffin was also of ironwood and would keep this poor remnant very well for 1,000 years and more. Stokes let go of his arm, and Tim went forward on his own. He knelt. He slipped one hand into the linen shroud's overlap and found his da's hand. It was cold, but Tim did not hesitate to entwine his warm and living fingers with the dead one's. This was the way the two of them had held hands when Tim was only a small one and barely able to toddle. In those days, the man walking beside him had seemed 12 feet tall and immortal. Tim knelt by the bier and beheld the face of his father. When he came out, Tim was startled by the declining angle of the sun, which told him more than an hour had passed. Cosington and Stokes stood near the man-high ash heap at the rear of the smithy smoking roll-ups. There was no news of Big Kells.
Perhaps he's throwed hisself in the river and drowned," Stokes speculated.
"Hop up in the wagon, son," Cosington said. "I'll drive you back to your ma's."
But Tim shook his head. "Thank ye. I'll walk if it's all the same to you."
"Need time to think, is it? Well, that's fine. I'll go on to my own place. It'll be a cold dinner, but I'll eat it gladly. No one begrudges your ma at a time like this, Tim, never in life."
Tim smiled wanly. Cosington put his feet on the splashboard of his wagon, seized the reins, then had a thought and bent down to Tim.
"Have an eye out for Kells as you walk, is all. Not that I think you'll see him, not in daylight. And there'll be two or three strong fellas posted around your home place tonight."
"Thank you, Si."
"Nar, none of that. Call me Peter, lad. You're old enough and I'd have it."
He reached down and gave Tim's hand a brief squeeze. "So sorry about your da. Dreadful sorry." Tim set out along Tree Road with the sun declining red on his right side. He felt hollow, scooped out, and perhaps it was better so, at least for the time being. With his mother blind and no man in the house to bring a living, what future was there for them? Big Ross's fellow woodcutters would help as much as they could, and for as long as they could, but they had their own burdens. His da had always called the home place a freehold, but Tim now saw that no cottage, farm, or bit of land in Tree Village was truly free. Not when the Covenant Man would come again next year, and all the years after that, with his scroll of names. Suddenly Tim hated far-off Gilead, which for him had always seemed, when he thought of it at all, which was seldom, a place of wonders and dreams. If there was no Gilead, there would be no taxes. Then they would be truly free. He saw a cloud of dust rising in the south. The lowering sun turned it into a bloody mist. He knew it was the women who had been at the cottage. They were bound in their wagons and traps for the burying parlor Tim had just left. There they would wash the body that had already been washed by the stream into which it had been cast. They would anoint it with oils. They would put birch bark inscribed with the names of his wife and son in the dead man's right hand. They would put the blue spot on his forehead and place him in his coffin. This Hot Stokes would nail shut with short blows of his hammer, each blow terrible in its finality. The women would offer Tim their condolences with the best will in the world, but Tim didn't want them. Didn't know if he could bear them without breaking down once again. He was so tired of crying. With that in mind, he left the road and walked overland to the little chuckling rivulet known as State Brook, which would, in short order, bring him to its source point, the clear spring between the Ross cottage and barn. He trudged in a half-dream, thinking first of the Covenant Man, then of the key that would work only once, then of the pookie, then of his mother's hands reaching toward the sound of his voice. Tim was so preoccupied that he almost passed the object jutting from the path that followed the course of the stream. It was a steel rod with a white tip that looked like ivory. He hunkered, staring at it with wide eyes. He remembered asking the Covenant Man if it was a magic wand and heard the enigmatic reply,
"It started life as the gear shift of a Dodge Dart."
It had been jammed to half its length in the hard pan, something that must have taken great strength. Tim reached for it, hesitated, then told himself not to be a fool. It was no pookie that would paralyze him with its bite and then eat him alive. He pulled it free and examined it closely. Steel it was, fine forged steel of the sort only the old ones had known how to make.
Very valuable, for sure, but was it really magic?
To him it felt like any other metal thing, which was to say, cold and dead.
"In the proper hand," the Covenant Man whispered, "any object can be magic."
Tim spied a frog hopping along a rotted birch on the far side of the stream. He pointed the ivory tip at it and said the only magic word he knew, "Abacadabra." He half expected the frog to fall over dead or change into, well, something. It didn't die, and it didn't change. What it did was hop off the log and disappear into the high green grass at the edge of the brook. Yet this had been left for him. He was sure of it. The Covenant Man had somehow known he'd come this way. And when? Tim turned south again, and saw a flash of red light. It came from between their cottage and the barn. For a moment, Tim only stood looking at that bright scarlet reflection. Then he broke into a run. The Covenant Man had left him the key. The Covenant Man had left him his wand. And beside the spring where they drew their water, he had left his silver basin, the one he used in order to see. Only it wasn't the basin, just a battered tin pail. Tim's shoulders slumped, and he started for the barn, thinking he would give the mules a good feed before he went in. Then he stopped and turned around. A pail, but not their pail. Theirs was smaller, made of ironwood, and equipped with a glossy handle. Tim returned to the spring and picked it up. He tapped the ivory knob of the Covenant Man's wand against the side. The pail gave back a deep and ringing note that made Tim leap back a step. No piece of tin had ever produced such a resonant sound. Now that he thought of it, no old tin pail could reflect the declining sun as perfectly as this one had, either.
"Did you think I'd give up my silver basin to a half-grown sprat like you, Tim, son of Jack? Why would I, when any object can be magic? And speaking of magic, haven't I given you my very own wand?"
Tim understood that this was but his imagination making the Covenant Man's voice, but he believed the man in the black cloak would have said much the same if he had been there. Then another voice spoke in his head. "He's made of lies from boots to crown, and his gospels bring nothing but tears." This voice he pushed away and stooped to fill the pail that had been left for him. When it was full, doubt set in again. He tried to remember if the Covenant Man had made any particular series of passes over the water. Weren't mystic passes part of magic? And couldn't. All Tim could remember was the man in black telling him that if he disturbed the water, he would see nothing. Doubtful, not so much of the magic wand as of his ability to use it, Tim waved the rod aimlessly back and forth above the water. For a moment there was nothing. He was about to give up when a mist clouded the surface, blotting out his reflection. It cleared, and he saw the Covenant Man looking up at him. It was dark wherever the Covenant Man was, but a strange green light, no bigger than a thumbnail, hovered over his head. It rose higher, and by its light, Tim saw a board nailed to the trunk of an ironwood tree. Ross Kells had been painted on it. The bit of green light spiraled up until it was just below the surface of the water in the pail, and Tim gasped. There was a person embedded in that green light, a tiny green woman with transparent wings on her back. "It's a Sig, one of the fairy folk." Seemingly satisfied that she had his attention, the Sig spun away, lighted briefly on the Covenant Man's shoulder, then seemed to leap from it. Now she hovered between two posts holding up a crossbar. From this there hung another sign, and, as was the case with the lettering on the sign marking out the Ross Kells stake, Tim recognized his father's careful printing. "Ironwood Trail ends here," the sign read. "Beyond lies Fagonard." And below this, in larger, darker letters, "Traveler, beware." The Sig darted back to the Covenant Man, made two airy circles around him that seemed to leave spectral, fading trails of green glow behind, then rose and hovered demurely beside his cheek. The Covenant Man looked directly at Tim, a figure that shimmered, as Tim's own father had when Tim beheld the course in the water, and yet was perfectly real, perfectly there. He raised one hand in a semicircle above his head, scissoring the first two fingers as he did so. This was sign language Tim knew well, for everyone in Tree used it from time to time. "Make haste, make haste." The Covenant Man and his fairy consort faded to nothing, leaving Tim staring at his own wide-eyed face. He passed the wand over the pail again, barely noticing that the steel rod was now vibrating in his fist. The thin call of mist reappeared, seeming to rise from nowhere. It swirled and disappeared. Now Tim saw a tall house with many gables and many chimneys. It stood in a clearing surrounded by ironwoods of such great girth and height that they made the ones along the trail look small. Surely, Tim thought, their tops must pierce the very clouds. He understood this was deep in the endless forest, deeper than even the bravest axeman of tree had ever gone, and by far. The many windows of the house were decorated with cabalistic designs, and from these Tim knew he was looking at the home of Merlin Eld, where time stood still, or perhaps even ran backward. A small, wavering Tim appeared in the pale. He approached the door and knocked. It was opened. Out came a smiling old man, whose white, waist-length beard sparkled with gems. Upon his head was a conical cap as yellow as the full earth sun. Water Tim spoke earnestly to Water Merlin. Water Merlin bowed and went back inside his house, which seemed to be constantly changing shape, although that might have been the water. The mage returned, now holding a black cloth that looked like silk. He lifted it to his eyes, demonstrating its use. A blindfold. He handed it toward Water Tim, but before that other Tim could take it, the mystery appeared. When it cleared, Tim saw nothing but his own face and a bird passing overhead, no doubt wanting to get home to its nest before sunset. Tim passed the rod across the top of the pail a third time, now aware of the steel rod's thrumming in spite of his fascination. When the mist cleared, he saw Water Tim sitting at Water Nell's bedside. The blindfold was over his mother's eyes. Water Tim removed it, and an expression of unbelieving joy lit Water Nell's face. She clasped him to her, laughing. Water Tim was laughing, too. The mist overspread this vision, as it had the other two, but the vibration in the steel rod ceased. Useless as dirt, Tim thought, and it was true. When the mist melted away, the water in the tin pail showed him nothing more miraculous than the dying light in the sky. He passed the Covenant Man's wand over the water several more times, but nothing happened. That was all right. He knew what he had to do. Tim got to his feet, looked toward the house, and saw no one. The men who had volunteered to stand watch would be here soon, though. He would have to move fast. In the barn, he asked Bitsy if she would like to go for another evening ride. The Widow Smack was exhausted by her unaccustomed labors on Nell Ross's behalf, but she was also old and sick and more disturbed by the queerly unseasonable weather than her conscious mind would admit. So it was that, although Tim did not dare knock loudly on her door, knocking at all after sunset took most of his resolve, she woke at once. She took a lamp, and when by its light she saw who stood there, her heart sank. If the degenerative disease that afflicted her had not taken the ability of her remaining eye to make tears, she would have wept at the sight of that young face, so full of foolish resolve and lethal determination.
"You mean to go back to the forest?" said she.
"Aye," Tim spoke low but firmly.
"In spite of all I told thee?"
"Aye."
"He's fascinated you. And why? For gain? Nay, not him. He saw a bright light in the darkness of this forgotten backwater, that's all, and nothing will do for him but to put it out." "Sigh, Smack, he showed me something to do with your mother, I wot. He knows what levers move folk, aye, none better. He has magic keys to unlock hearts. I know I can't stop thee with words, for one eye is enough to read your face, and I know I can't restrain thee with force, and so do you. Why else was it me you came to for whatever it is you want?" At this, Tim showed embarrassment, but no flagging of resolve, and by this she understood that he was truly lost to her. Worse, he was likely lost to himself. "What is it you want?"
"Only to send word to my mother, will it please you. Tell her I've gone to the forest and will return with something to cure her sight." Sai Smack said nothing to this for several seconds, only looked at him through her veil. By the light of a raised lamp, Tim could see the ruined geography of her face far better than he wanted to. At last she said,
"Wait here. Don't skitter away without taking leave, lest you'd have me think thee a coward.
Be not impatient either, for thee knows I'm slow. Although he was in a fever to be off, Tim waited as she asked. The seconds seemed like minutes, the minutes like hours, but she returned at last.
I made sure you were gone, said she,
and the old woman could not have wounded Tim more if she had whipped his face with a quirt. She handed him the lamp she had brought to the door.
To light your way, for I see you have none.
It was true, in his fever to be off, he had forgotten. Thank ye, sigh. In her other hand, she held a cotton sack.
There's a loaf of bread in here. 'Tisn't much, and 2 days old, but for provender, 'tis the best I can do.
Tim's throat was temporarily too full for speech, so he only tapped his throat 3 times, then held out his hand for the bag. But she held it a moment longer.
There's something else in here, Tim. It belonged to my brother, who died in the endless forest almost 20 years ago now. He bought it from a roving peddler, and when I chaffed him about it and called him a fool, easily cozened, he took me out to the fields west of town and showed me it worked. Aye, God, such a noise it made. My ears rang for hours.
From the bag, she brought a gun. Tim stared at it, wide-eyed. He had seen pictures of them in the widow's books, and old Destry had on the wall of his parlor a framed drawing of a kind called a rifle, but he had never expected to see the real thing. It was about 1 foot long, the gripping handle of wood, the trigger and barrels of dull metal. The barrels numbered 4, bound together by bands of what looked like brass. The holes at the end, where whatever it shot came out, were square.
He fired it 2 times before showing me, and it's never been fired since the day he did, because he died soon after. I don't know if it still will fire, but I've kept it dry, and once every year, on his birthday, I oil it, as he showed me. Each chamber is loaded, and there are 5 more projectiles. They're called bullets.
Bullets? Tim asked, frowning.
Nay, bullets. Look, you.
She handed him the bag to free both of her gnarled hands, then turned to one side in the doorway.
Joshua said a gun must never be pointed at a person unless you want to hurt or kill him. For he said, guns have eager hearts. Or maybe he said, evil hearts. After all these years, I no longer remember. There's a little lever on the side, just here.
There was a click, and the gun broke open between the handle and the barrels. She showed him 4 square brass plates. When she pulled one from the hole where it rested, Tim saw that the plate was actually the base of a projectile, a bullet.
The brass bottom remains after you fire, said she. You must pull it out before you can load in another. Do you see?
Aye.
He longed to handle the bullets himself. More, he longed to hold the gun in his hand and pull the trigger and hear the explosion. The widow closed the gun. Again it made that perfect little click, and then showed him the handle end. He saw 4 small cocking devices meant to be pulled back with the thumb.
These are the hammers. Each one fires a different barrel, if the cursed thing still fires at all. Do you see?
Aye.
It's called a 4-shot. Joshua said it was safe as long as none of the hammers were drawn.
She reeled a bit on her feet, as if she had come over light-headed.
Giving a gun to a child. One who means to go into the endless forest at night to meet a devil. Yet what else can I do?
And then, not to Tim, but he won't expect a child to have a gun, will he? Mayhap there's white in the world yet, and one of these old bullets will end up in his black heart. Put it in the bag, do you? She held the gun out to him, handle first. Tim almost dropped it. That such a small thing could be so heavy seemed astounding. And like the Covenant Man's magic wand, when it had passed over the water in the pail, it seemed to thrum.
The extra bullets are wrapped in cotton batting. With the 4 in the gun, you have 9. May they do you well, and may I not find myself cursed in the clearing for giving them to you.
Thank ye, sigh.
It was all Tim could manage. He slipped the gun into the bag. She put her hands to the sides of her head and uttered a bitter laugh.
You're a fool and I'm another.
Instead of bringing you my brother's foreshot, I should have brought my broom and hit you over the head with it.
She voiced that bitter, despairing laugh again. Yet 'twould do no good with my old woman's strength. Will you take word to my mama in the morning? For it won't be just a little way